This is the second in a series of presentations recorded at the Visions 2012 conference in Minneapolis, an event for people with blindness and low vision sponsored by the Foundation Fighting Blindness. For our monthly programs, we've selected those speakers whom we have found to be most appropriate for our audience. These presentations are also available in audio from the Foundation's website at www.blindness.org. We are grateful to the Foundation Fighting Blindness for making these recordings available to the public, and we hope you will enjoy the variety of topics we've chosen. This month's topic is participating in clinical trials. In the first part, you will learn of the many aspects of clinical trials, specifically inclusion and exclusion criteria, what to expect during study visits, open label versus placebo-controlled studies, and why clinical trials are important. The second part will present doctors who will describe three major clinical trials now underway. The first presenter is Dr. David Birch, Chief Scientific and Operating Officer of the Retina Foundation of the Southwest in Dallas, Texas.
What I will try and do, just in a sort of brief overview, is kind of give you some background on clinical trials and what they're all about. And I think it's only sort of natural that I'll be probably focusing more on the trials that I know about and I'm involved in, but I want you to realize that there are trials going on at many different sites in the country. Why clinical trials? Now, I think this is all fairly new. It's new to the foundation, and it's in some ways new to medicine. I mean, the whole clinical trial push has really been the last 20 years or so. Before that, it was common for doctors to just try things, you know, or patients to try things. A lot of the advances, a lot of the medicines that were developed never really had trials. They just sort of ended up in practice. And this whole sort of random process had some major, major problems. And there were lots of cases of patients dying from interactions with drugs or wrong drugs, people going blind because of inappropriate eye treatments. So over the years, a sort of a mechanism has become formalized for bringing some new therapy or potential therapy to the clinic, to market. And that's that whole mechanism really is kind of encapsulated in this concept of a clinical trial. Now, not everybody goes by the rules. And if you Google stem cells, you know, on the internet, you're going to find lots of individuals who will willingly inject stem cells somewhere in your body and tell you that it's going to cure retinal disease. You know, so there's no law saying, well, there are laws, yeah. But there are ways that there are people that will get around these, and there are still quote, treatments out there which have not gone through this whole process, have not gotten FDA approval, have not gotten sort of the stamp of approval from the field. And, you know, those of you that have been around a while can remember the Russian treatment, the Cuban treatment, these other treatments that were widely touted, and the investigators doing them often were well-intentioned, and they accumulated data to suggest that there was a benefit, but they never did a trial. They never actually compared it to the natural history of the disease. They never really demonstrated that what they were doing was beneficial. They were depending primarily on the anecdotal statements of patients. And the problem there is that the patients that like it will tell you they like it. The patients that don't will disappear, you know, and so you get a very biased kind of view. So we have this mechanism, and the idea for treatments come from basic science. I mean, there are lots and lots of labs supported by the foundation that are looking at drugs, stem cells, treatments that might be efficacious. And generally, a phase one trial, in our field anyway, a phase one trial is the initial trial that is the first time that some new treatment is put into humans. Often these are done by the investigator themselves. So somebody working on a particular type of gene therapy will run the phase one trial themselves. They will do the groundwork. They'll do the animal safety work. They'll do all the sort of conditions that are required before you can put something into humans. And there are, you know, very straight, very well thought out steps before you can put something into a human. But the phase one trial is generally the first time that this particular agent is put into a person. And these are usually very small trials. They're usually 8 or 10 people. And the whole emphasis really is on the safety, you know, is to make sure this potential treatment is not doing any harm. We always look for some sign of benefit, but the main thing is safety, because we know that in 8 people or 6 people, we're not going to be able to prove anything one way or the other. You know, we may get some indication of benefit, but it's not going to really prove anything. So an example that I'm very familiar with is what's called the CNTF trial, which was a trial of a growth factor that we felt was neuroprotective, could protect the retina. And there was evidence from animals, lots of different genetic models of RP, that this CNTF was good. You know, it was really going to preserve the vision. And the initial CNTF trial, the phase one trial, was 10 patients, and it was done by Paul Sieving in Washington. And he showed that this was a safe procedure. And so we proceeded into phase two. So phase two then becomes a much larger group of patients. And often in phase two, you have more than one site doing it. What you try to do is broaden the whole approach. You try to get 80 or 100 patients involved. And the key to a phase two trial is that you have a placebo. So for the first time in the development of this new drug, you're actually comparing the drug to a dummy. And so some patients get the dummy, some patients get the drug. And in the best designed phase two trials, which the CNTF was, neither the patient nor the people testing the patient know which patient got what, which eye got what. So the trial involved about 100 people, and in the best of all worlds, we would have found a significant difference between the eye that received the CNTF and the eye that didn't. Now, the trial was designed to show a benefit. In other words, we picked our numbers, picked our tests, based on the notion that the eye getting the CNTF would show an improvement in visual field relative to the eye that didn't get it. And we didn't find that. So over 18 months, there was no difference. And so we can say with a lot of confidence that CNTF does not improve the visual field. And the trial was a perfectly designed trial. Everything was done, you know, nobody dropped out. All the criteria were met. It's a very solid finding. No benefit from CNTF. So the trial itself was successful as a trial, not successful as a treatment. We talk about participating in a trial. You have to realize that we are fully aware of the favor that you're doing the field. I mean, you guys are making a huge sacrifice to be in a trial. And we often get people calling us wanting to be in a trial, desperate to be in a trial. And I have to explain to them, this is not an opportunity to get treated, okay? Because we don't know if this is going to help you. What you're asking to do is to volunteer many, many hours, you know, many visits to our facility. There's a 50% chance that you will get nothing, that you'll get a placebo. There's a pretty good chance that even if you get the active, it may not work. You know, this is not a treatment. This is not, you're not missing out on something if you can't get into a trial. So what I always do is sort of applaud the people that volunteer, because they're doing a tremendous service to their fellow patients and to the field. I mean, we can't move ahead without your participation. But I don't think you should take it personally or be bothered if you can't get into a trial, because there are just lots of reasons why you wouldn't get in. You may not have dominant RP. We may not know your mutation. Your visual field may not be big enough. You may be taking drugs that interfere. You know, there's lots of reasons why you wouldn't qualify. So I think I'll leave it at that. I mean, I think we're now in the age of trials, right? From now on, there will be trials going on all the time. And we're all dedicated to testing every lead. And we have sites that are capable of doing this. We have investigators that are eager, and we'll get it done. But don't be offended if you're not eligible for a particular trial.
Part two of this presentation will be descriptions of three major clinical trials currently underway. Dr. Stephen Rose of the Foundation Fighting Blindness will introduce the speakers.
We have three individuals here who are representing clinical trials in cell therapy, drug therapy, and gene therapy. The speakers for this session are Dr. David Saperstein, Dr. Matthew Vincent, and Dr. David Wilson. Dr. Saperstein is a practicing vitreoretinal surgeon at Vitreoretinal Associates of Washington. Dr. Matthew Vincent is the Director of Corporate Development at Advanced Cell Technologies Incorporated, which has stem cell clinical trials underway for Stargardt disease and a dry age-related macular degeneration. Dr. David Wilson is Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology, Director of the KCI Institute, and the Thiele Petty Chair in Ophthalmology at the School of Medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University. With that, I'm going to turn over to our first speaker, Dr. David Wilson, who's going to talk about two gene therapy clinical trials, one for Stargardt, one for Usher 1B.
Thanks, Stephen. In terms of my message, it's really summed up in three words, which is really optimism, patience, and engagement, because I think right now there's every reason to be optimistic about the new trials in treating inherited diseases. We know from what's the advances in genetics, the gene defects for so many of these diseases, and now there's FDA trials in place for Stargardt's disease, Usher's 1B, and LCA, and those are progressing very well. So just as by way of a little bit of background, what's meant by gene therapy is the replacement therapy that can be done with primarily one of two viruses. The virus is used to place the defective gene in the retinal pigment epithelium or the retina. And for the type of virus that's used is dependent on the size of the genes. In all of these treatments, the way that the virus is given is by an infusion of the fluid underneath the retina. And these are specially designed to just place the gene in the cells but not replicate within the cells so that there's not the risk of dissemination. So the site where the gene is placed is based on some very specific testing to look where vision can be preserved and no damage is done to the retina. So the procedure is a very straightforward procedure. It's one that's done all the time for other retinal disorders. It's done in an outpatient setting, and generally the patient's vision returns to its baseline very soon after therapy. So it's extremely well tolerated, and in the trials that have gone to date, there's been very few treatment-related adverse events, so that's a reason to be optimistic. But I do want to reinforce that the trials need to be done in a very specific way, and as with all new agents, the trials are designed first to develop or to determine if there's any side effects, and then to determine the proper dosage of the treatment. And so those have to be conducted and are going very well. So that's where patience comes in, because in order to get these answers, it takes several years to develop the treatments. And so those trials now were in with Stargardt's and Usher's, we're enrolling patients in these trials. We expect that trial, which is a safety and dosing trial, will be completed in 2013. And I think there's every reason to be optimistic that the trials will progress to larger scale trials. The last part that I was going to mention is engagement, because I think there's a lot of way for people to be engaged in trials of this type. One is just coming here and being knowledgeable about the treatments that are available. And for patients, the trials are open to enrollment. It'll be much easier for patients to participate once we reach larger scale trials. And then there'll probably be more centers, and it won't require quite as much on the patient to become involved. The other type of engagement is really supporting organizations like FFB. These trials involve a sponsor which has provided the biotechnology, but for them to be successfully completed, it really does take external support. So I'd really encourage people that are able to support organizations like FFB that really make these trials possible in so many ways. I'd just like to summarize by saying this is an extremely exciting time for the treatment of genetic eye disease, and I think, as has been mentioned, we're now able to do clinical trials that address the underlying defect in the diseases, and we're all looking forward to the next few years where we actually have lots of results to talk about and hopefully effective treatments. Thanks very much.
So now we'll hear from Dr. Saperstein, who's going to talk to us about the QLT clinical trials in RP and Leber's congenital amaurosis.
Thank you, Steve. It's really a pleasure to be here to present the results of our two clinical trials that we did with QLT. What I'm going to be talking about is a new drug called QLT-091001 that is an oral medication for the treatment of LCA and RP. There's three things that I'd really like you guys to come home with from this talk, and if it's the only three things you remember, that's great. First of all, this drug that I'm going to talk about is a retinoid, but it's not vitamin A. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we've completed two clinical trials, and we were able to safely expand the visual field and improve visual acuities and activities of daily living. And the third thing is that this work would not have been possible without lots of basic science research. And a lot of this was funded by the Foundation and the National Eye Institute and other organizations. So when you guys hear about the clinical trials, it's really easy to get excited about that. And sometimes you forget about, or you want to kind of put the basic science stuff aside. You think that's done. But it's not. There's still a lot to learn. And the more we learn about basic science in these eye diseases, the more treatments are going to come out of that. So I just want you to keep those three things in mind. So let's talk about vitamin A first, though, and what vitamin A does in the normal eye. When you eat vitamin A, gets to your eye, and then it's converted in the eye to a special compound called 11-cis retinal. And the 11-cis retinal binds to opsin, and that becomes the active protein that can sense light and start the vision process in the eye. If you have mutations in RPE65 and LRAT proteins, those are the proteins that actually are responsible for making 11-cis retinal from vitamin A. So if you have a mutation in there, you don't develop 11-cis retinal, and then you don't have good vision. And so that's why in the gene therapy trials, they're replacing RPE65 in those patients to try and recreate that protein that's going to make 11-cis retinal. So those patients don't see because they have the RPE65 gene. They see because the new RPE65 gene made 11-cis retinal, and then they were able to see. Our idea was, instead of replacing the protein, maybe we could replace the 11-cis retinal. So 11-cis retinal itself, this transformed vitamin A, is not conducive to pharmaceutical development. It's very sensitive, and it's very difficult to isolate and keep stable. So we developed a more stable compound that does the same thing, or very similarly does the same thing. And we made it so it could be used orally. And then we treated a bunch of mice that had defects in the RPE65 gene and the LRAT gene, and also had decreased vision from these defects, and we were able to restore vision in the mice. We then went ahead and treated the same kinds of dogs with RPE65 disease that they treated with gene therapy, and we were able to improve vision in the dogs. So with that good basic preclinical proof of concept, we call it, we went ahead and we performed all the FDA preclinical required studies, toxicity, stability, manufacturing things. We did a study in healthy volunteers to prove that to show that the drug was safe. And then Rob Konacoup, who's a pediatric ophthalmologist and inherited retinal disease specialist in Montreal, began treating patients a few years ago. And the very first patient that he treated was a 10-year-old girl with LCA. She used a cane to ambulate. She had about 30-degree visual fields, and she used a closed-circuit TV at school to see the board. After 2 days of treatment, she developed a pretty bad headache and some photophobia, sensitivity to light. But she also said at that time that she thought she could see a little bit better. And after 7 days of therapy, by day 30, so 3 weeks almost after she stopped taking the drug, her visual field had expanded from the 30 degrees to 170 degrees. So she had had a great expansion of her visual field. She stopped using her cane. Dr. Konacoup had to write the school and tell them that was okay. She stopped using her closed-circuit TV. And this effect lasted for over a year, and then it started to tail off after that with just 1 7-day treatment. Today, we treated 14 LCA patients, and on average, their visual field increased by 140% of area, the area of the visual field. 11 of the 14 patients, or 79%, 8 out of 10, had improvement in at least one eye. So we called those patient responders. They really had an improvement. And almost half of the patients had significant improvements in their visual acuity, their ability to read. In a separate trial, we then treated patients who had early onset RP due to the same mutations. And our results were very similar to those that we found in the LCA. Okay, so we have all these nice tests, but what about the patients? Well, I told you the improvements that the first patient noted. All of the patients who had improvements noted improvement in ability to function in dimly lit situations. A few patients were able to get rid of their cane because of improvements in their visual field. Some patients also noted that they could read better with visual aids, and some even without visual aids. If all goes well, we should have an approved drug by 2014 in Europe and the U.S. Thank you. And our next speaker is Matt Vincent from ACT.
Thank you, David. Thank you all. What I'm going to talk to you a little bit today is about cell therapies. So my company, Advanced Cell Technology, is a cell therapy company, and our principal focus is on developing cell therapies for treating diseases of the eye. That is, we're making different types of cells which we hope can be used to either repair or replace damaged tissue in the eye that was damaged as a consequence to disease, or which can actually be used to preserve tissue or to hold off the loss of visual acuity as a consequence to these diseases. But before I get into our therapeutic programs, I want to tell you a little bit about the stem cells we use as our starting materials. We use an embryonic stem cell line we created in 2005 as the source of all the different cells that we make. This stem cell line is special to us. It was created using only a single cell taken from an embryo without either harming or destroying the embryo. From those single cells from 2005, we have generated a number of different cell lines. And these cell lines, by definition, can divide and divide and divide indefinitely. This one cell that we isolated in 2005 can ultimately be used to make literally trillions of doses of different cell therapies. From that, we can make all of these different cell therapies without ever needing to go back and make another embryonic stem cell line again. That one cell we isolated has been used to create a master stem cell bank that has been reviewed by the US FDA and by the British MHRA and has been deemed appropriate to be used in generating cells that can be used in human patients. So where did we begin with our cell therapies? We began in the back of the eye, the retinal pigment epithelial layer. The layer of cells that has been connected to so many macular degenerative diseases that have taken the sight of so many millions of people. We figured out by looking at how the cell forms during development that we could replicate the same signals and take the stem cell down the same pathway in a culture dish to produce a highly pure preparation of RPE cells, so pure that we could use these cells as part of a cell therapy. First, we had to extensively test these cells in animals to make sure that they were going to be safe in human patients, as well as to provide evidence to the FDA that these RPE cells, when we injected them into an eye, were going to get to the site of damage, engraft, and recapitulate the structure of the natural RPE layer. And we used a couple of different animal models to do this. One of them is a mouse model for Stargardt's disease. And when we injected human RPE cells into these animals, we were able to demonstrate when we took cross-sections of the animal's eyes that the human cells were able to find the spots in the RPE layer where the mouse RPE cells had been lost. So on July 12th of last year, we treated our first two patients. We treated one Stargardt's patient and one dry AMD patient. I don't know if any of you have seen the news stories that have come out on these two women. Absolute pioneers. I mean, when you enroll in a phase one study, you really need to be characterized as a hero. There is no expectation in a phase one study that there will be any efficacy of this drug in treating you, but rather you're volunteering because you want to help demonstrate that the drug is safe so that earlier stage patients may have a chance to get the drug either in later courses of the clinical study or ultimately when the drug is approved. We have now treated five Stargardt's patients between here and the UK. We actually have a Stargardt's trial approved in the UK. We've enlisted the aid as clinical trial sites of four of the top five eye hospitals here in the US, and really one of the top eye hospitals in the world in Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. And we continue to add clinical trial sites to our registry on a regular basis. We've also treated three dry AMD patients. We have approval now to move up to the next higher dose in the Stargardt's patients. What's nice so far is that we've not seen any evidence of adverse effects. Again, this as a phase one study was designed to look for issues of safety, and there really have been nothing that has created any concern either for the clinicians that are involved or for our data safety management review board. What we didn't expect to see in these patients, because they're all very late stage, they're all patients who have lost their vision to the point of legal blindness, was that we'd have any impact on visual acuity. What surprised us is that we've actually seen in these seven patients varying degrees of improvement in visual acuity. And they've been, for the first two patients who were treated last July, coming up on 1 year, there's been persistence to that. Now, again, we have a long way to go. We have many patients that we have to treat before we'll be able to say with any certainty that this is a statistically significant observation, that it's something that we will see in patients regularly, but it gives us a great amount of hope that we're on the right track ultimately to being able to have a cure for these diseases. So I'm going to close actually shifting gears a little bit. There is a need for us all to be adventurers. We have a summit we need to take together. You won't need crampons. You won't need an ice pick for this climb, though it is formidable. The peak is 28,600 feet lower than Mount Everest. It's only 400 feet above sea level, and it's Capitol Hill. We have a Congress who, through a combination of misinformation and being afraid to make bold suggestions, are really making no effort to advance or even support regenerative medicine and stem cell therapy. It is time that we change that mentality. It ought to be that not supporting regenerative medicine is received as the career-ending decision on the Hill, not the other way around. And when you hear anyone, especially a politician, saying that he or she thinks embryonic stem cell research requires the destruction of embryos, tell them they are wrong. Thanks.